Our first reading this morning is from Galatians 5. By contrast, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. There is no law against such things. And from 1 Corinthians 13. If I speak in the tongues of mortals and of angels, but do not have love, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains, but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give away all my possessions, and if I hand over my body so that I may boast but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. It bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. And now faith, hope, and love abide, these three, and the greatest of these is love. Excuse my phone. And from the Gospels, Luke 7. One of the Pharisees asked Jesus to eat with him, and he went to the Pharisee's house and took his place at the table. And a woman in the city, who was a sinner, having learned that he was eating in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster jar of ointment. She stood behind him at his feet, weeping, and began to bathe his feet with her tears and to dry them with her hair. Then she continued kissing his feet and anointing them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee, who had invited him, saw it, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what kind of woman this is who's touching him, that she's a sinner. Jesus spoke up and said to him, Simon, I have something to say to you. Teacher, he said, speak. A certain creditor had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii, the other 50. When they could not pay, he canceled the debts for both of them. Now, which of them will love him more? Simon answered, I suppose the one for whom he canceled the greater debt. And Jesus said to him, you have judged rightly. And then turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has bathed my feet with her tears and dried them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she's not stopped kissing my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she's anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which were many, have been forgiven. Hence, she has shown great love. But the one to whom little is forgiven loves little. Then he said to the woman, your sins are forgiven. But those who were at the table with him began to say among themselves, who is this who even forgives sins? And he said to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. This is the word of the Lord.
Good Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay. This morning, as we continue our series on life in the vine, we are shifting to begin looking more closely at the fruit that are cultivated in a life abiding in God's Spirit. Now, I don't think that the fruit of the Spirit that we heard read in Galatians 5, 22 to 23 are listed in their order for a particular reason, and we won't be handling the rest of the fruit in that order that they are listed there, except perhaps the first fruit in the list, I think, is the first fruit for a reason: love. Love really is the first fruit of the Spirit. Love is the origin of life in the Spirit. Love is the substance of abiding in the vine, and love is the end of life in the Spirit. Love is the first fruit, and it's the last fruit. 1 Corinthians 13:3 says, "And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love." This was one of the passages that we had read at our wedding, and I remember our friends, Neil and Renee, who did our homily, saying, "Faith and hope are great. They will do their jobs and then be given an honorable retirement. We won't need them anymore when God is right there with us. But love will remain just because we will be with God. We will be in the very presence of the one who is love. At the last, love remains because that is with whom we will be." So love is the first fruit and the last fruit of life in the Spirit. It's the beginning of life with God and the end of life with God. Now, thanks to the influence of some beloved older cousins, our daughter Bea has recently entered her Taylor Swift era, and specifically her Love Story era. And so this morning, as we discuss the fruit of love, I thought it would be appropriate to look at three love stories. Now, not the Taylor Swift kind of love stories, sorry, Bea, but stories of love. Three stories to help us understand what love is, how love grows, and what it looks like when love overflows. So for our first story, the setting is a small kingdom tucked against the backdrop of fjords in Norway. The time is, well, once upon. Yes, our first story, our first love story, we are going to Arendelle. Okay, kids. kids, can you help me? What is the love story in Frozen? Frozen 1. We're talking Frozen 1 here. What's the love story? Okay. Yeah, okay. Is the love story Prince Hans and Anna? Is the love story Kristoff and Anna?
No.
No. The real love story that's being told in Frozen is the love of two sisters. So spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen Frozen, I'm just going to tell you everything that happens. Not everything, but. Sisters Anna and Elsa love each other very much, but Elsa has a strange power within her. She can create ice and snow. And one day, she accidentally strikes her sister with ice. Fortunately, her parents know who can help, and they take the girls to trolls deep in a forest. The trolls warn Elsa that fear will be her enemy. I guess her parents interpret that to mean that other people being afraid of her will be the enemy, and so they decide to hide Elsa's secret, isolate her from anyone whom she could hurt or who might discover her power. Long story short, this does not turn out well for anyone. Fast forward several years, and once again, Elsa is terrified of this thing within her and her capacity to hurt those whom she loves, especially her sister. She runs away. She tries to distance herself. She is full of fear, and she accidentally strikes her sister's heart with a ray of ice, a blow to the heart that could be fatal. Once again, Anna goes to the wise forest trolls and is told, "Only an act of true love will save her." Now, Anna and everyone else who reads fairy tales assumes that they mean true love's kiss will save her. But the surprise twist in the end is that it is not true love's kiss. It is literally an act of love, an action of love that will bring healing. Near death, Anna sees the turns out to be a bad guy, Prince Hans, about to kill her sister Elsa, and she lunges to intercept his sword in order to protect and save Elsa's life, even at the risk of her own. This is the act of true love. In Frozen here, we see that love is not a sentimental feeling. Love is a fierce, determined action. In this story, love is risky, love is sacrifice, love is undeterred by fear. Fear, in fact, is in competition with love. In her own efforts to defeat that which within her that she knows can harm others, she controls, isolates, she applies fear and anxiety, when all along, love is the thing that has the stronger power. She discovers that love allows her power to thaw the eternal winter that she'd brought upon Arendelle. Love is the thing that can undo the scariest parts of her, the hurt, the harm that she has caused. When love is given dominion, that which would be a curse actually becomes a gift. So love is not a sentimental idea. Love is sacrificial. Love is embodied action that is out to get fear. For our second story, our second love story, we are going to the Gospel of Luke. Now, it's actually really hard to find a story in the Gospels that is not a picture of love. Jesus is love embodied. And so if we want to more deeply know love, we just look to Jesus and ask, what does love look like here? How does love show up? In fact, one of my favorite ways to kind of devotionally or prayerfully spend time in gospel scripture stories is to read them and then look for love. Follow love and stay with it. But I had to choose one story today. So today we are going to look at this particular love story that we heard read from Luke 7. This is a story of love and devotion. But what fascinates me in this story is that Jesus explicitly tells us something about how love grows, how love is cultivated. So the setting is a dinner party. A well-known, respected religious teacher has invited Jesus to his house for dinner. Everyone is buzzing about this dinner event. In Luke's gospel narrative up to this point, we've seen some tense conversations and encounters between Jesus and the teachers of the law, but they've never sat down together for dinner yet. And just before this dinner scene in Luke, the disciples of John the Baptist are sent by John to ask Jesus, "Are you the one we're waiting for? Or is there someone else that we need to wait for?" Jesus doesn't give a yes or no response to the question. He just says, "Go and tell John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have good news brought to them." It's like Jesus is saying, "Listen and see. Put together the puzzle pieces." So you can imagine the buzz that's going on in the city. Jesus, without explicitly naming his identity yet, is basically saying, "Look, I am embodying the fulfillment of the prophets. I am embodying Messiah." And now he's going to be sitting down for dinner with the teachers of the religious law. Everybody is talking about it, so much so that a very non-invited woman decides to show up at the party. Not only is she not invited, but she is also very not welcome. All Luke tells us about her is that she is a woman who is a sinner. We can presume that was her reputation. Simon the Pharisee, who is the dinner host, says to himself, "If Jesus knew what kind of woman she is, that she's a sinner, he would definitely not let her near him. Obviously, he is not a prophet." Simon sees this woman in contrast to the people at the table, a sinner out of place in a room of respected law followers. Jesus, on the other hand, sees love. Jesus sees a love story being played out. Now, Jesus also sees her in contrast to the people at the table, but what he sees is the contrast in love. His host, we learn, did not even offer him conventionally appropriate hospitality. It would have been conventionally appropriate to offer water to wash one's feet, to greet a friend with a kiss. It is appropriate to anoint an honored guest with oil. Simon, it seems, has offered minimal hospitality beyond extending Jesus an invitation to his house. This woman, on the other hand, has shown Jesus unconventional hospitality. She has taken the cultural norms of hospitality beyond the boundaries of appropriate. It's over the top, awkward, risky, extravagant, genuine love. Now, as I said before, what I find really fascinating this story, especially in when we're in this place of considering the fruits of the Spirit and what does it look like to cultivate fruit of the Spirit in our lives, is that Jesus turns the scene in Luke into a lesson on how love grows, on where love comes from, on how love is cultivated. Jesus tells a parable about two people who owe money. One owes 50 denarii and one owes 500. So a denarii is about a day's wage of skilled labor. So you can think about one person owing 2 months' worth of salary, approximately. So that's not a debt you want to have, but assuming you continue to get that same salary, you know, it's within the realm of possibility to, you know, have a plan to pay it off steadily. The other person owes 10 times that much, closer to 2 years' worth of salary. Now, carrying that size debt, that is going to have a huge impact on that person's life for a long time, probably for their whole lifetime. Both people have their debts canceled completely. So at the end of the day, the external status of both people is the same. They are each debt-free. However, the internal experience of the creditor's debt-forgiving action is quite different. For one person, the debt forgiveness is good news. It's one less thing they have to worry about and plan for. It probably made their day. For the other person, the debt forgiveness is life-altering news. Going from owing 500 denarii, or close to 2 years' worth of salary, to being debt-free will completely change the outlook and possibilities of that person's life. Having this kind of debt forgiven doesn't just make your day, it makes your life. The same external status of being debt-free, but a very different internal experience, and a very, very different internal fruit, if you will, cultivated in the person through their experience. Jesus asks, "Now, which of them will love him more?" It's a pretty strange question to put to the story. It's a question that concerns the formation of the person, what the experience has done in them. The answer is obvious. Simon knows it. Of course, the person with the greater debt, who experiences the life-altering forgiveness of the debt, will have much more love for the person who canceled their debt. So then Jesus brings attention back to the love story in the room that's happening. Back to this woman. Jesus highlights her extravagant love. "Look at her," he says. "Forget about your labels and boxes. What I see is a woman who has just shown me extravagant, over-the-top, sacrificial love." Jesus can see that this is a woman who has had a great debt canceled. This is a woman who has experienced great forgiveness. This extravagant love that the whole dinner party has witnessed, this is the love of a person who knows life-altering debt cancellation. Love grows by experiencing great forgiveness, by being on the receiving end of extravagant grace. You know, I enjoy imagining what it felt like for Jesus to be on the receiving end of this extravagant grace. Of this over-the-top show of love. I wonder, did it make Jesus uncomfortable? Did it feel a little awkward? Or was he moved? Was he captivated by the earnest, authentic, risky, self-conscious-less love of this woman? In my imagination, I wonder if Jesus recognized this kind of love as familiar. It looked totally weird to everyone else, but I wonder if Jesus was like, yeah, I know this kind of love. This is my kind of love. This is the love of God that extravagantly pours out on people. She gets it. She has experienced my kind of love. Love begets love. So how does the first fruit of the Spirit grow in us? None of the fruits of the Spirit are things that we can just muster up in ourselves. Just there's a limit to our efforts to make ourselves more loving. So how do we make space for the Spirit of God to grow in us? By receiving love. By letting ourselves be loved in the places where we are most ashamed, most afraid of judgment. Letting the love of Christ search out those places and thaw them with love so that we can be embraced in forgiveness and grace. In this story in Luke, it's not really about who has sinned more, the woman or Simon. It's about who has received more forgiveness. Receiving requires a posture of humility, honesty, and openness to grace. Cultivating the fruit of love means that we do not run away from our need for grace and forgiveness. It means that we must not be afraid of our own spiritual poverty. It means leaning into humility, not in a self-deprecating way, but in a way that allows us to live uncovered and unashamed. It's one of the reasons that we practice confession every week during our time of communal worship. In his book, Praying Like Monks, Living Like Fools, Tyler Statton says, "The issue with sin isn't that God has a tight moral grid and coloring within the lines is how we prove we're on his side. It's that sin inhibits us from doing what we are made to do best, love, to receive love and to give it." And so in confession, we can have curiosity as we let the Spirit search us. What keeps me from fully loving God and from freely loving others? I can start by considering what keeps me from loving those in my literal house and extend to my friends and community and extend to my enemies, extend to the work of justice, love that is lived out in the public sphere. I can let God uncover and prune those things in me. Love grows as we receive God's love, God's grace, God's forgiveness. The fruit of confession and knowing our need for forgiveness is not guilt and shame. The fruit of confession and receiving grace is a response of love, extravagant, risky, sacrificial love, like we see from the woman in this story. Love story three. This story is set in a time when culture is shifting in unprecedented ways. There is a push for upward mobility and wealth. The gap between the poorest and the richest is growing. It's a time of social division. It's a time of corruption in politics and in the church. A time when wars and violence are being started and maintained in the name of religion. You guessed it. 13th century Umbria, Italy. So my dear friend, Francis Di Bernardoni, who we'll just call Francis, he's also known as Francis of Assisi, was born to a successful, upwardly mobile merchant family. In his youth, he spends his father's money and indulges in the lavish lifestyle it affords him. He is driven by romantic ideals of chivalry, and he gets involved fighting in local wars, hoping to gain honor and perhaps even become a knight. However, his story takes a dramatic turn. He becomes disillusioned with the direction of his life, with his pursuit of wealth, pleasure, honor, and status no longer satisfy him. Francis's conversion happens over a period of time. First, he slowly turns away from each of his old loves and the passions that drove his life. Then he experiences a sort of listlessness. He knows what he has been called away from, but he doesn't know the new way of life that he is called to. He spends hours praying in these abandoned, crumbling church buildings. People think he's crazy. Finally, he is praying one day in one of these crumbling churches in front of a crucifix when he hears the voice of Jesus speak to him from the cross and say, "Francis, rebuild my church, which you see is falling into ruins around you." Francis takes this literally and starts spending his days physically repairing these abandoned church structures. However, over time, it becomes clear that this vocational calling is bigger than he could imagine. By the end of his life, through his vocation of radical poverty and service to the poor, his winsome preaching of the gospel, his witness of peacemaking, and his life of prayer and intercession, Francis brought incredible renewal to a church that was mired in corruption. Now, Francis is beloved by many branches of Christians and by non-Christians. He is a hero to those who value justice, poverty, peacemaking, environmental care, and animal lovers. If you were looking for inspiration from someone who founded a community and a movement with incredible social and spiritual impact, Francis is your person. I often think that if the Mennonites were into having saints, Francis would be their patron saint. Toward the end of his life, though, Francis wrote his spiritual testament, kind of like a spiritual autobiography. There are so many places where he could have started his colorful story. There are tales from his upbringing, stories of God speaking to him in dramatic ways. There are miracles and signs all throughout his years of ministry. Instead, he starts his entire story with an obscure encounter that he had. So there were leper colonies at this time outside of the town of Assisi. And Francis writes that before, he used to have great fear and abhorrence of these lepers. He was nauseated by the sight of them. Then one day, while he's out, he encounters a leper, and God gave him the grace to embrace and show mercy to this person who previously would have repulsed him. You see, Francis is remembered and considered a hero for many things, but he knew that the true miracle of his life was his conversion to love. The true miracle of his life was his falling in love with the person of Jesus, and the miracle of that love expanding the capacity of his own love. Every fruit of Francis's life and ministry was an overflow of this conversion to love. His life of radical poverty that he's known for was not intended as a countercultural statement, although it certainly was countercultural. It was a byproduct of his pursuit of love. Francis knew that in his context, where wars broke out regularly between neighboring cities, if he possessed property or wealth, he would have to protect it. And that would create a barrier between him and others. Francis wanted to eliminate anything that might become a barrier to his capacity to love and embrace the other. Francis did not set out to start a movement or even a community. It was actually a surprise to him when other people started joining him. He writes in his testament, "God gave me brothers." He said, it was an unexpected gift. He was not driven by anxiety or a need to make an impact. He was driven by love. He was driven to love, to Jesus, who embodied a life of love. And he let the love of Jesus prune him, letting go of his former priorities and preoccupations. He let the love of Jesus expand him so that he could embrace the ones who had repulsed him before. He let the love of Jesus guide him, and he let the love of Jesus overflow through him in service and witness. People like to make a hero out of Francis, myself included. Those who admire him want to make him into a role model by looking to his legacy. We wonder if we should mimic his decisions, his outward activities, or replicate his ministries. But really, we must look at the source of his life, the internal fruit that overflowed into a life that served and impacted many. If we want a life like that, it will only come as an overflow of deep love. Love that prunes us, love that transforms us, love that expands us to embrace others. We need our own love story. So, what will be your love story? What will be our love story? This morning, we've seen in the stories we looked at that love is not merely sentimental. Love is an embodied action that is out to get fear. We've seen that love is cultivated by receiving love, grace, and forgiveness. And we've seen what it looked like for a particular person in their particular context for the fruit of love to overflow. And I am convinced that anything of deep value that comes out of us as individuals or as a community must be a byproduct of this cultivated spiritual fruit of love. It won't come from feeling like we're not enough, like we need to do more or be something more. It won't be motivated by fear or anxiety. If we want to offer our gifts and passions to meet the world's needs, if we are to participate in God's work in this world, if we long to bear witness to the beauty of the gospel, it must be from an overflow of love. It will be the fruit of our love story. Amen.